Practice of making unconstitutional stops, searches, and arrests, using enforcement strategies that produce severe and unjustified disparities in the rates of stops, searches, and arrests of African Americans, using excessive force, and retaliating against people engaging in constitutionally protected expression.
Currently, the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution does not actually ban slavery or involuntary servitude. What it does is ban slavery and involuntary servitude for people who are not convicted of a crime.
Walmart is owned, as you know, by the Walton family, which is one of the biggest funders of charter schools in the country. And from 2010 to 2015, the Walton family spent more than $1 billion to privatize schools. So they pledged to spend another billion over the next 5 years to expand a system that has basically caused deep cuts in public school funding.
And welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW, Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Avam. Well, are you as tired of the Trump-trained media coverage as I am? I'm really tired and disgusted by it. I'm also tired of the jingoistic coverage of the Olympics. NBC really knows how to take the joy out of clean sports, but despite the poor coverage, they couldn't take away the joyous performances of gymnast Simone Biles or swimmer Simone Manuel. But WPFW is here, radio for the people, so needed in these times of Orwellian doublespeak, lies, damn lies, and PR spin. Gerald Horn is back with us today talking about, among other headlines, the latest Department of Justice report that details the horror we already knew of Baltimore's black community basically living in a totalitarian Jim Crow police state. We'll also hear from the president of the Washington Teachers Union, Elizabeth Davis, about an action getting underway this morning at Moton Elementary School in Southeast D.C. that is part of a national action to discourage teachers and parents from buying school supplies at Walmart because of the chain's deplorable labor practices and because Walmart's owners, the Walton family, are huge supporters to the tune of $1 billion of privatizing public schools. Yes, as always, we have a jam-packed show for you. Here are our activism headlines. Activists in the Movement for Black Lives are soundly rejecting harsh criticism from the Israeli lobby because the movement's new national platform denounces Israel's occupation of Palestine as genocide. Organizations including the Jewish Community Relations Council in Boston and the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, condemn the platform and all groups that support it. In a section titled Invest, Divest, the platform accuses the U.S. of complicity in, quote, the genocide taking place against the Palestinian people, end quote, refers to Israel as an apartheid state and calls for ending U.S. military and financial aid to Israel, arguing that it diverts much needed funding from domestic education and social programs in the U.S. National Public Policy Chair of BYP 100, Janae Bansu, who spoke to On the Ground about the new platform last week, told Electronic Intifada, quote, when a united front of over 50 black organizations produces something that is transformative in its vision, I'm not surprised that folks are wanting to hone in on one specific detail of the platform at the expense of really addressing the very important problems we shed light on, end quote. Though Bansu wasn't directly involved with the Israel-related section of the platform, she added, I am in support of Palestine and stand by what the platform says 100%. The murder of Michael Brown and subsequent militarized police attack in Ferguson, Missouri 2 years ago this week consolidated the Black Palestinian Solidarity Movement because at the same time, hundreds of civilians were dying in the attack by Israel on the Gaza Strip that killed more than 2,000 people. And speaking of Gaza, Google has been accused of deleting Palestine from Google Maps, but The Guardian reports that Palestine was never labeled by Google in the first place. The Guardian says that when searching for Palestine on Google Maps, it shows an outline, but with no label for Palestine and Israel labeled alongside it. While 136 members of the United Nations recognize Palestine as an independent state, the U.S. and much of the West does not. The representation of Palestine on Google Maps has not changed recently, but after the Forum of Palestinian Journalists released a statement condemning Google, word spread via social media and later news outlets. People began sharing their outrage using the hashtag Palestine is here. A Google spokeswoman said, quote, there has never been a Palestine label on Google Maps. However, we discovered a bug that removed the labels for West Bank and Gaza Strip. We're working quickly to bring these labels back to the area, end quote. The Guardian added that a petition from March of this year urging Google to include Palestine on their maps has gained traction in the last few days. It now has almost 315,000 signatures. Well, in D.C., today's action about Walmart is not the only one about back to school. In recent days, the ACLU of the National Capital Area held a series of town hall meetings about the status of girls of color in D.C. public schools. Chantel James has more.
In the wake of such sobering statistics as the fact that black girls are six times more likely to be suspended from school as white girls, the D.C. ACLU convened several town hall-style meetings designed to provide a forum for people to voice their concerns and find solutions. Titled Leaving Girls Behind, the lively conversation at the Ward 7 Town Hall meeting at the Capitol View Library included former D.C. public school girls, parents, and educators. Participants talked about the many ways girls have been wronged by the D.C. public school system, proposing all-girls schools as a solution. Alicia Rucker, activist and educator,
DCPS knows full well that they're undereducating our children. We can look at statistics west of the park and east of the river, and it's sickening, and they know it. We need to raise our children up now. This is an emergency, starting Monday when school starts, because it's not good enough to be at the 59th percentile. They're already behind the rest of the world. DCPS needs to get their act together.
For more information, visit www.aclu-nca.org. For On the Ground, this is Chantal James signing off.
And there is lots of preparation for upcoming events and actions in the nation's capital. The Jericho Movement is holding a town hall against police murders and mass incarceration on Saturday, August 20th at 2 p.m. at Gethsemane Baptist Church, 5119 4th Street in Northwest D.C. For more information, go to townhallforjustice.org. There was also organizing in Northwest D.C. in support of a national work stoppage by prisoners planned for September 9th. Chantel James spoke to members of the International Workers of the World.
Workers of the World hosted an event to try and garner membership and to alert the public of the upcoming prisoner strike. At the meeting, participants learned what they could do to support the prisoners, such as letter-writing campaigns. Cal Cogan speaks on the 13th Amendment and prisoners' rights.
Currently, the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution does not actually ban slavery or involuntary servitude. What it does is ban slavery and involuntary servitude for people who are not convicted of a crime. But for people who are convicted of a crime, it basically allows, under our current Constitution, people to pay, as Katie was mentioning, people to be paid sub-poverty wages. A lot of prisoners will do a lot of manual labor work throughout the United States, from manufacturing and rolling cigarettes to installing hardwood floors to making license plates to doing roadside community highway maintenance for cents an hour.
At the event, dubbed a seditious feast, vegan fare was served. For more information on how you can support the prisoners in their strike, email ghq@iww.org. For On the Ground, this is Chantal James signing off.
And last night, there was a kickoff for the 2016 Black Love Fest, returning after several years during the Congressional Black Caucus weekend on September 18th. The Black Love Fest will be held at the Gateway DC Pavilion in Southeast DC. This year's festival is a tribute to Black Lives Matter. And tomorrow is WPFW's third annual Blues Festival at Lamont's Complex in Pamunkey, Maryland, starting at noon. Go to WPFWFM.org for more information. And those are our headlines and happenings. Check WPFW's social justice calendar and activist alerts by the Washington Peace Center for more. Okay, so we're going to go to a break. And when we come back to school with a boycott of Walmart. Stay with us. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Averam. On Monday, thousands of D.C. public school teachers will head back to the classroom to prepare for the big opening of school on August 22nd. And actually, 11 D.C. schools are opening Monday, this coming Monday, in an effort at year-round learning and the extended school year. And today, the president of the Washington Teachers Union, Elizabeth Davis, is joining with commercial and food workers and other teachers at a press conference to draw the public's attention to the role of Walmart in how it works against public schools. And she is with me on the line. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Esther, and thank you for inviting me.
So tell me about today's action. Why Walmart?
Well, as you know, over 5,000 of our teachers are reporting back to school, and many of them will be forced to dig into their pockets for classroom necessities. The national average that a teacher will spend on his or her own, that they spend of their own money for supplies is $500. But here in the district, many teachers spend much more than that. They do so because they're professionals, they care deeply about their students, and they want to ensure that their students have the necessary supplies. Above all, they want all of their students to get off to a fair start. But Walmart is sponsoring a contest this year where students will get a chance to nominate teachers to win money for back-to-school supplies. But this is not a genuine corporate philanthropy. It's a cynical cover-up. Walmart is owned, as you know, by the Walton family, which is one of the biggest funders of charter schools in the country. And from 2010 to 15, the Walton family spent more than $1 billion to privatize schools. So they pledged to spend another billion over the next 5 years to expand a system that has basically caused deep cuts in public school funding. And, of course, the rally that we're having today is about that issue.
So how is Walmart and the Walton family funneling this money? Are they directly funding privatized schools? Are they giving money to organizations like ALEC or that are pushing this agenda? How are they actually doing this?
Some of both. They're giving money directly to fund charter schools, privatized public schools. As you know, in D.C., we have closed over 40 public schools over the past decade. And we have opened charter schools in many of the areas, especially the underserved areas. And this whole campaign that they're launching is offensive. It's offensive to our members. It's offensive to our union. And so we're partnering with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union to hold this rally because we want to urge our teachers and our parents to avoid buying school supplies at Walmart. this year. Our message is simply shop locally, shop online, just don't shop at Walmart.
I know that there, as we speak, there are probably parents out right now shopping and trying to get ready, or they will this weekend and next weekend.
Parents and teachers both look for, the most reasonable prices they can find. And, of course, the union is going to put forth some alternatives. When we ask them not to shop at Walmart, we want to give them alternative places to shop, and we're going to provide that type of information to our members as well as to our parents. But every purchase they make at Walmart is a moral choice. We don't believe that our teachers should patronize a company like Walmart that exploits its own workers and undermines public school employees. So when I think that our teachers and parents will begin to understand that. I haven't shopped at a Walmart store in over 10 years for that very reason, because of their reputation, not only nationally, their global reputation.
So if there are parents listening now who may not be able to get the information through TV or the website or whether, do you want to give the recommendations now?
Absolutely. They can contact the WTU directly. Call 293-8600. That's 202-293-8600. Ask to speak to Janet Lopez, or they can simply email us at dialogue@wtulocal6.net. And of course, we're going to post information on our website. We're going to e-blast information to all of our members. And this campaign, of course, is going to continue throughout the year. Our rally today is we've invited our Ward 8 Education, Board of Education members, council members, parents, teachers, and other community stakeholders to attend this rally because we think that this message is important for us to get out to the community citywide.
Well, I know also this action dovetails with the actions by Walmart workers that have occurred in recent years to basically get this employer, I think still the nation's largest employer, to abide by fair labor practices and to treat their workers properly, pay a fair wage. Can you tell me about that collaboration?
Well, yes, and then that's one of the reasons why we have partnered with UFCW, because teachers understand that the lessons we teach in our classrooms every day goes beyond the 3 R's. We want our students to become critically literate about social justice issues such as this. And of course, everything that happens, even if it happens to our students, their families, their parents, many of their parents work for Walmart. We want students to learn the lesson that we need to stand up and demand that employees in every, no matter what job, what profession, should be treated fairly. And Walmart's reputation as an employer is deplorable. And we want them to change. We want our members to be a part of that change. We want our students to understand that what we teach them every day in the classroom is also to help them change unsatisfactory conditions in the workplace and in their communities. So this is more than just a lesson plan. This is also a lesson for our members, for our students, and also encouraging our members to understand the importance of teaching our students how to navigate through unfair situations such as the way Walmart treats its employees. It is something that is definitely connected to our schools and everything we do in our classrooms every day.
Now, of course, the new school year will be beginning as these 4,800 teachers, I believe, are still working without a contract and have been working without a contract for, 6 years now?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, what's happening with that?
Well, I don't know if you're aware, but we recently, I was reelected about 4 weeks ago.
And, yes, congratulations.
Thank you. Prior to the election, the chancellor announced to the city council, specifically David Grosso's Committee on Education, that she was suspending the contract negotiations until after our union election, which I thought was inappropriate. However, the election ended weeks ago. We are still waiting for her to come back to the table. I've invited her, given her dates to do so. And although I know that she has announced her resignation as of, I believe, October 1st, she'll be stepping down. I believe that she should fulfill her promise and her commitment to return to the bargaining table to finish the contract on two issues that we could not resolve. And one of those issues was on compensation for teachers. So I'm hoping that she will honor her word, the word that she gave to city council on public television that she would resume negotiations after the union election. And, of course, the union election has ended. So I am still reaching out to her and the mayor because I had hoped that teachers would be able to return to school this school year with a new contract. They deserve it, and also they also deserve the recommendations, the proposals that we're asking to say how much we appreciate teachers, to pay them the salaries that they deserve, and we're not asking for anything more than that.
How has this extended school year impacted teachers, and how does this extension figure into the contract and how teachers should be compensated?
Well, as you know, the extended year was not negotiated with the union. It was arbitrarily done by the chancellor and the mayor, and we have filed an unfair labor practice around that issue because that is an issue that should have been bargained with the teachers' union. Anything that deals with the changes of salaries, working conditions, and work hours is something that should be bargained with the union. We want to play by the rules, and we ask that the school district do the same. So we're still waiting to hear when this issue come up in arbitration as to whether or not the extended year was done. But more importantly, Esther, we are also, as educators, we're also looking at the research behind extending time in school as opposed to looking at how the time is used already, the 7.5 hours in which students are already in school. We believe that if we begin to rethink how that time is used, because many teachers know that a lot of that time has been spent in the past decade on testing, test prep, drill and kill testing skills. The focus of the curriculum has been basically on the test. Teachers simply want to be able to teach content. And when they've not been able to do that, and we've sort of moved a lot of the time that teachers are spending in their classrooms now, a lot of the time is spent on test-taking skills with testing. Too much testing. Parents even agree with us. So we really want the school district to examine the how to better utilize the 7.5 hour day. Because we have a number of schools, high-performing schools, where students have a well-rounded, rigorous curriculum, and they're doing it within a 7.5 hour day. And the students are doing well. So we need to take a look at how we're utilizing the time as opposed to keeping students in school a longer day to do more of the same. It's like baking a bigger cake, as if things are going to improve if you're using the same ingredients.
Right. I saw a documentary recently about how short the school days are for so many children in Europe. I think it was the highest performing country in terms of education.
I was at an international summit 2 years ago with 16 countries that are leading the way, the highest performing school districts in the world, Sweden, Shanghai. And you know, what they shared was how the teachers, and in many of the schools, in Shanghai in particular, they talked about the fact that teachers taught 3 classes, 30 minutes a day, but they had the highest achieving students in the world. So what are we doing wrong? We need to adopt some of those practices. Teachers were given more time to collaborate and plan together. We don't do that here. Here we're taking away planning time from teachers as opposed. So we're basically doing the opposite of what some of the best, highest performing school districts in the world are doing. So we need to look at best practices and what the research says actually works. One thing I can say, Esther, is that we have an opportunity to hit the reset button now. We are in the process of choosing, selecting a new chancellor. And this is a chance. There's so much opportunity available to this school district to sort of redirect. We have ESSA with all of the changes that were made to the No Child Left Behind bill. That's opportunity for our school district to not only collaborate with all stakeholders, but to engage the voice of teachers, the ones who are working closest with students in the classroom. They are the experts. I've taught for 44 years, so I think I know something about teaching. And I was a highly effective teacher all 44 years.
So we're talking this year probably, 50,000 students of returning to D.C. public schools?
Approximately 50,000, and we're looking to increase those numbers. That's one of the goals of the teachers' union as well as the school district. We want to make our public schools a magnet to basically retrieve some of those students that have left the system for charter schools.
Well, we know that the parents of all those children will be getting school supplies. We have teachers buying supplies for their classrooms, and so the message today from teachers and Walmart workers and folks gathered at the press conference today is to don't buy those supplies at Walmart, to be an activist. This is a way that you can be an activist as a parent, as a teacher, to support public education and support Walmart workers and all those who supply Walmart in terms of making that corporation accountable.
Yes. We're going to offer some solutions to teachers as throughout the year, options for where they can shop the school supplies as well as the parents.
Okay. And give that phone number and email address again for people who would like to connect with you to get that information.
Great. The phone number is 202-293-8600. Ask for Janet Lopez. And the email address is dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at WTULocal6.net. And we will respond right away with any questions you may have.
Okay. Well, I've been speaking to Elizabeth Davis, president of the Washington Teachers Union, 4,800 strong, recently reelected president. Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for joining me this morning.
Thank you for inviting me. Have a good day.
If you're just tuning in, this is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio here in D.C. I'm Esther Averam, and that was the interview I just had with Elizabeth Davis, president of the Washington Teachers Union, before their action today out at Moton Elementary School in Southeast D.C. to encourage teachers and parents to not buy those school supplies at Walmart. Walmart is heavily investing in privatizing our public schools, and they want to encourage teachers and parents and anyone supporting our students as they go back to school to not shop at Walmart, to be activists. I thought that I would give some of the topics and things that we've covered in recent weeks. We brought you Marilyn Mosby's tremendous statement on the dropping of charges and the death of Freddie Gray. Really extraordinary in terms of implicating police officers in working against the state and making the case. The voices of protest at the DNC, climate activists blockading the DNC headquarters right here on Capitol Hill. That was actually a tremendous action to see people like Margaret Flowers, Green Party candidate, locked arm in arm, by PVC pipe to people blocking the entrance of the DNC headquarters. And she was out there with many other climate justice activists before they went to Philadelphia for the DNC. The Brave New Voices poetry competition at the Kennedy Center. I think thousands of young people, poets from around the country there to perform, to share their love of poetry. And we brought you that here, right here on Friday mornings on the Ground. Voices from Flint and other areas of environmental justice, or I should say environmental injustice around the country with Michelle Roberts, our co-host, and also the People's Convention that happened at the DNC. So we had so many different things in the recent weeks. Awesome discussions with Color of Change activists around the movement for Black Lives. We're going to go to a brief break right now. Stay with us. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Ivarum. Well, the latest Department of Justice report details the horror we already knew of Baltimore's black community, basically living in a totalitarian Jim Crow police state. Every media outlet seems to have its own top 10 of the worst in the report. For example, even corporate media like CNN lists a teenager being arrested for loitering on his own porch. An innocent man stopped for crossing the street in a hoodie, winds up tased and beaten in the face. A woman strip searched and cavity searched on the street in public after a traffic stop and then released. With me to discuss the DOJ report and other headlines is our geopolitical analyst, the prolific writer and activist Gerald Horn, whose recent books include Confronting Black Jacobins, The U.S., The Haitian Revolution, and The Origins of the Dominican Republic, and Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning to you.
So thanks for joining me this morning. Let's start with your reaction to the DOJ report. It's shocking, but it seems like what's shocking in these reports that come out seems to be normalized, like when nothing's done about it.
Well, you are correct. There are so many negative reports of that nature coming out, it's hard to keep track of them. You might have seen the front page of the New York Times just a day or two ago that suggested that the medical community, doctors, nurses, are relatively oblivious to the pain that black patients suffer, and as a result are reluctant to prescribe painkillers to them, which has the upside, of course, meaning that black people generally have escaped the tidal wave of opioid abuse that is ravaging many in the Euro-American community. But it's the ultimate commentary, quite frankly, on the black condition in the United States, that is to say, being oblivious to black pain. I think at a certain point, even radicals have missed the boat with regard to what's happening in the United States. That is to say, that if you get to the root of this problem, it's clear, to me at least, that the problem is this state, the United States of America, was established on the basis of slavery. And, of course, black people who were the slaves fought against that. And then it was established on the basis of Jim Crow and apartheid. And, of course, black people fought against that, too. And we're still being punished and ravaged because not only of our fight back against the state, but also our penchant and proclivity for making global alliances to help to leverage our rather perilous condition here in North America. The United States has a nice little hustle going. It's whenever anything like this happens, we are told that this does not reflect U.S. values, where anything positive does reflect U.S. values. Now, if any other state took such a ludicrous position, we'd laugh them out of court. But even some progressive forces take that kind of position, echoing President Obama, who says, that's not who we are. Well, I'm afraid that's who we are. And until we recognize that's who we are, we won't be able to diagnose and then prescribe a remedy for this festering malady.
You know, as you were talking, it reminded me of one of our headlines and the fact that the movement for Black Lives has been denounced by these pro-Israel lobby groups because of the position in their new platform that condemns Israel as an apartheid state and calls the occupation of Palestine a genocide. And it reminded me when I was either reading or listening to these denunciations that these people are living certainly in an altered universe than me, because when I, you know, when you look at thousands of people dying and you look at the denial of fresh water, the total destruction of their infrastructure that would allow them to live, that to me, what else can you call it but genocide? So it sounds to me like also this whole alliance between African Americans and Palestinians is part of that international alliance or that type of alliance that you're talking about.
Well, you are correct. That's one of the more heartening aspects of today's situation. You might have seen the report that Al Jazeera did on the relationship between Black Lives Matter and the Palestinian movement. I recommend it to your attention. Likewise, the Black Lives Matter movement or certain activists have been speaking out at the United Nations, They've been in Brazil in solidarity with black activists in Brazil fighting back against police brutality. We know that the parents of Michael Brown, the slain Ferguson, Missouri teenager, were marking the second anniversary of his murder just this month. Were in Geneva, Switzerland, speaking to United Nations representatives just some months ago. I think this kind of activity is not only heartening, but it needs to be escalated and put on the fast track. Otherwise, it seems to me we're doomed and destined for some sort of slow motion strangulation.
Well, speaking of Brazil, I think the Senate voted there to impeach Dilma Rousseff, and that seems to be moving that process along when a lot of people were thinking that it didn't really have much of a chance of necessarily succeeding, that she was getting enough votes to perhaps dodge the bullet. So what do you think about what's happening with Rousseff?
Well, obviously, the progressive thrust in Latin America has received some setbacks. Not only the fact that President Kirchner in Argentina, when she stepped down, her designated successor was not able to succeed her. We already know that in Venezuela, President Maduro is on the ropes. And we'll probably have to await the opening of the files in the designated Obama Presidential Library in Chicago in order to figure out what the Obama administration was doing to help push these kinds of reactionary changes along. But certainly it's fair to say at this point that as of 2009, 2010, there was grave concern in Washington about the rise of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. And since that time, you've seen this setback in Brazil. You hear this war talk with regard to Russia and China. And then, of course, you've just had the setback of the African National Congress government in South Africa. I'm not sure if all of this is coincidental.
Yes, and actually, before I leave Brazil, I didn't know if you've been watching the Olympics and saw the gold medals won by two African-American athletes, the two Simones, Simone in gymnastics and Simone Manuel in swimming, if you had any reaction to that.
Well, obviously, I'm particularly heartened by the triumph of Simone Biles, the gymnast who has roots in Belize in Central America, one of the few English-speaking countries in Central America. The whole nation has been riveted by her performance. But I'm also riveted, I'm afraid to say, by the fact that the Cold War has invaded the Olympics. I'm sure you must have seen the U.S. swimmer who splashed water in the face of a Russian swimmer, and the fact that the Paralympics team of Russia has been barred from the Olympics, supposedly and allegedly because of a doping scandal. The BBC did a very useful report just this morning pointing out that there's a grave sense of victimization in Russia because of how their athletes have been treated. This does not contribute to international peace and security, and in fact contributes to the kind of insecurity that is helping to propel the loose talk we hear in Washington about war with Russia and or China.
You know, I actually did talk about that at the top of the show, that I am so disappointed and really disgusted by NBC's coverage of the Olympics. It actually is feeding into a lot of very corporate media narratives in the political realm outside of sports. And for example, Tom Brokaw, who's totally just bankrupt in terms of any type of like integrity, as far as I'm concerned, on the air, he talked about the impeachment of Rousseff, and he talked about the current interim president Temer as if he was a really good guy. You know, he's just kind of like, oh well, you know, this president is under impeachment, and you know, and I just was like, you know, why don't you tell the whole story? You know, if you're going to bring it up, why don't you tell the truth? And then also, Chuck Todd was talking about the country's politics in a very kind of jingoistic way and talking about Russia. And I just feel like they're doing the public a real disservice by sullying what should be a real celebration of sports with these politically biased commentaries that just, you know, ring hollow, and just more than ring hollow. But you were going to talk about South Africa, and we only have about three more minutes, but the ANC suffered a setback in the elections, but some observers are saying that you know, the Western media just would like to to pick on the ANC. You know, what's the truth?
Well, it's no question that there was a setback for the ANC. And I also have to subscribe to the critique of President Jacob Zuma, who is a kind of embarrassment because of the corruption that led to his building up his estate in Nkonlo in the Indian Ocean coast of South Africa by looting the public treasury. And not to mention his rather casual male chauvinism as represented in the fact that he was accused of raping a woman young enough to be his granddaughter, a daughter of a comrade, and then he and his comrades launched a scurrilous attack against her, and this somehow compelled the ANC Women's League to come to his defense, not her defense, which helps to embarrass the ANC Women's League. But for those who think that this setback of the ANC will lead the ANC to the left may need to think again, because a major beneficiary was the so-called Democratic Alliance, whose roots in part lie with the old National Party, the party of apartheid. And not only that, but the so-called left-wing contender, the Economic Freedom Fighters, led by Julius Malema, who was formerly with the ANC and once pledged to die for President Zuma, now is threatening to go into alliance with the Democratic Alliance, even though their platforms are diametrically opposite. Malema has talked about nationalizing factories and the land, and the Democratic Alliance, as the party of white privilege and supremacy, is totally opposed to that. And if that happens, of course, the economic freedom fighters will discredit themselves, probably allowing for an ANC surge in the next elections. So people need to stay tuned. Also, it seems to me that many of our friends in the United States, they need to realize that economic redistribution is no dinner party. I was very disappointed to see that when Zimbabwe moved in that direction, some of the most blood-curdling threats against the regime in Harare were launched from progressive forces in the United States of America. Obviously, this was a signal to the ANC to move, do not move in that direction. And so for those on the left who took their position against Zimbabwe, now to push the ANC to go down Zimbabwe's path is an utter contradiction that they need to resolve sooner rather than later.
So before we wrap up, is there any other kind of global issue that you wanted to mention before we sign off?
Well, 2 points. One is that this loose war talk in Washington about war with Russia and or China needs to be taken very seriously. RAND Corporation, the think tank in Santa Monica, California, has been thinking the unthinkable, including pointing out a scenario where the United States could prevail in a war with China without launching nuclear weapons. We know that Russia and China will be having military maneuvers within the next few weeks. This is in part a response to the fact that the United States has installed an anti-missile defense system in South Korea, supposedly to thwart North Korean missiles, but Russia and China in the neighborhood see this as a direct threat to themselves. Similarly, the U.S. warships have been sailing around the Spratly Islands claimed by China. This has the prospect of leading to an enhanced conflict. And secondly, this presidential election has echoes of 1964, when progressive forces put their shoulder behind the wheel to make sure that an erratic Barry Goldwater of Arizona, a conservative Republican, would not have his finger on the nuclear button. He was hostile to civil rights. But we wound up getting Lyndon Baines Johnson elected, who then began to rain bombs down on Vietnam in 1965, leading to the resurgence of the right in 1968 with Richard M. Nixon. Let us hope that history does not repeat itself in 2017.
Well, we'll definitely keep our eye on all of these issues. And I want to thank, let me see, Professor John Rollins. Thank you so much for your generous contribution this morning. He's a sustainer and a renewing sustainer. And I thank you so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Professor John Rollins, for helping us to make our goal this morning on the ground. Thank you, Gerald.
Thank you.
Okay. And that will do it for us on the ground, onthegroundshow.org. Thanks again to our guests, Professor Gerald Horn and Elizabeth Davis, president of the Washington Teachers Union. And special thanks to Chantel James for all her reporting this week. and putting up with me. And thanks to our engineer, Mike Nasella. And thank you for listening and donating, which you can still do. I'll get credit for everything up until the top of the hour or even past that if you designate it for On the Ground. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. Please don't forget to like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Radio Show. On the Ground Show. I'm Esther Rivera. Keep calling 202-588-9739 or go online to wpfw.org. Raise your voice out there. Peace.
I didn't mean to take up all your sweet time.